Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, and it is September 22nd. And here's a sign-in sheet. Make sure you sign in. And, oh, I tell you what, I need it back. You could have signed in, but I need it back for just a second. All right, so today, some of you might have a practicum in lab, and in lecture, we're going to cover joints. All right, some general discussion of joints, general classification of joints, and look at a particular joint as an example. All right, so another name for a joint is articulation, right? Articulation and joint are exactly the same thing. And an articulation is where two bones come together, and that might allow motion and it might not allow motion. But any connection between two bones that isn't completely ossified over or completely boned over, then we call that an articulation. Right? That helps give the human skeleton mobility as well as the ability to hold itself together. Like, for instance, the cranium, all the bones that make up the cranium. Like, give me a couple bones in the cranium. Parietal and frontal. Yeah, there's a suture between them. There's a joint between them, but it's an immovable joint, right, that holds the head together and protects the brain. And we can classify joints by one of two kinds of general categories, either by their structure or by their function, and sometimes we use both. All right, so by a structural classification, it's based on the material that binds bones together. And this classification scheme just uses three designations. There's either a fibrous kind of joint, a cartilaginous, or a synovial type. So this is by their structure. So if it's a fibrous joint, what is the joint made out of mostly? Fibers, and take a guess, which kind of fiber? It's going to be the strong fiber, it's going to be a collagen fiber. So it's going to be maybe like a ligament, because a ligament is a bone-to-bone connection that's made out of dense, regular connective tissue. All right, another kind is cartilaginous. That's not as strong as a fibrous joint. Might allow some kind of motion, maybe a little bit, but the primary material that's between those two bones is cartilage. For instance, it could be fibrocartilage, like in the pubic symphysis or intervertebral disc between the bodies of vertebrae. All right, and then the last classification is a synovial joint. And a synovial joint has a number of important pieces to it, like it has a synovial membrane, it has synovial fluid in it, right? It has a number of components, and we're going to look at all those components later on in lecture. All right, so those are the three ways that we can classify joint by structure, not necessarily by how it functions, but by structure. Okay, the second classification is a functional classification, and it focuses on the amount of mobility that joint allows. So some joints are not movable at all, or very, very little motion is hardly noticeable. We would call that a synarthrosis. And a good example of that would be a suture that you're familiar with in the skull. An amphiarthrosis is a slightly movable joint, like the intervertebral discs. And that's a fibrocartilage joint, so that's also what? By structure, that's a cartilaginous joint, but it is slightly movable. And then the last kind is a diarthrosis kind of joint, and by motion, that is a freely movable joint that allows for the most mobility between bones. Okay, and a really good example of that would be your elbow or your knee, right? Or even knuckles between the phalanges of your fingers. All right, so it's easy to understand what a fibrous joint is, and easy for a cartilaginous joint because it has cartilage, right? And synovial joint, you'll see what makes up a synovial joint. But how on earth are you going to remember, all right, synarthrosis, amphiarthrosis, and diarthrosis? Little trick that I do is I just take the first letter of each of those words, and it says what? sad, right? And just say in order of those letters right there, you have increasing mobility. So it's kind of directly related. All right, so synarthrosis, the S in synarthrosis is the least movable, the amphiarthrosis is intermediate, and the diarthrosis is what we call freely movable, right? And it is the most movable of that group right there. All right, so we got three designations in each of these. All right, so let's first talk about fibrous joints, and this is a classification by what kind of scheme? Structure, right? By structure. Okay, so it's a classification scheme by structure. All right, fibrous joints are connected by dense regular connective tissue, namely ligaments, right? And they lack a joint cavity. There's no cavity between the bones. It's just completely filled up with these fibers. And we've got a couple different kinds right here. We've got sutures between the skull bones. And if we look at the slide on the right, we can see what a suture is. So here's a suture between like the frontal bone and parietal bone, right? And between the parietal bone and temporal bone right there. And that's held together by what? Fibers, by collagen fibers. All right, the next kind is a syndesmosis. And again, it's held together by fibers because it's a fibrous kind of joint, like the distal talofibular joint right here. And there's even a proximal talofibular joint that approximates these two bones, and it limits the amount of motion between these two bones as well. All right, so that, again, doesn't have any kind of joint cavity. These bones are held together by this dense regular connective tissue. Okay, and there's another kind. Let me see if I can find another kind. Maybe you can remember what it was, and that is the interosseous membrane between the tibia and fibula. And I don't have a picture. I'm going to have to go back to a previous slide if I'm going to see it, so I don't want to go back to a previous slide. But there is an interosseous membrane between the ulna and the radius, and between the tibia and fibula, and of course between the radius and ulna, what can you do with your hand? You can pronate it, and you can supinate it, and that joint between those two bones is a movable joint. Right, it just helps stabilize those bones, but it does not prevent motion. Okay, so the radial ulnar interosseous membrane is an important example of that. And then the next example of a fibrous joint is a peg and socket kind of joint. Oh, where's my picture? Here it is. Okay, it's a peg and socket kind of joint. So here we have a tooth inserted into the... Where's the tooth going to insert? Okay, an alveolus, right? An alveoli is plural. An alveolus, and where is that alveolus at? What bone? Maxilla or mandible, either one, right? Upper jawbone, lower jawbone, right? And since we might want to consider a tooth a bone, right? This connective tissue right in here is going, since it's a bone-to-bone connection, then that would be considered a ligament. And that's what holds that tooth into the alveolus, that periodontal ligament, right? And you also have pain receptors in this area too. Maybe you've been chewing something at some point in your life, like a hamburger or something, and there was a little bit of bone in the hamburger and you chewed down on it and it bent the tooth a little bit in the socket right there, and it probably hurts really bad. And that's because you just inadvertently stretched out this periodontal ligament as a result of that. But that, as far as I know, grows back just fine. Okay, so those would be examples, nice examples of fibrous joints. Next classification, cartilaginous joints. Again, that's a structural kind of classification. It's going to have different kinds of cartilage in it. And these are, we have two categories, a synchondrosis and a symphysis. All right, so synchondrosis, that's pretty easy to tell that that's a cartilaginous joint, because what makes up one root of this word right here? Chondro, right? And that just really means cartilage, as you see on the left-hand side. All right, so synchondroses are united by hyaline cartilage. And, these are a synarthrosis kind of joint. And when we say synarthrosis, it belongs to that scheme that's SAD, synarthrosis. So in terms of mobility, It just so happens that all of these are what? Are immovable kinds of joints, right? So the synarthrosis is immovable, amphiarthrosis is slightly movable, and diarthrosis is freely movable. Okay, but a synchondrosis is a synarthrosis. So let's see if we can find where some of these are. Okay, so the synchondroses, all right, a good example would be the epiphyseal plate at the epiphyses of a long bone, okay, and that's also important because you should know what is the function of this epiphyseal plate right here. Growth, right, and sometimes we actually call it a growth plate, and it should not be movable, right, you shouldn't be able to compress that joint, you shouldn't rotate that joint, because if you do, that damages its function, and that bone will stop growing at that location. Okay, and this is before puberty, and then right around puberty, that ossifies over, and that synchondrosis joint disappears altogether and becomes very stable. Another example is between the first rib and the manubrium right here, and this is another immovable joint. Okay, between the end of rib number one and the manubrium. So those are the cartilaginous or joints, in particular the synchondrosis. So that just leaves the symphysis. The symphysis type cartilaginous joints have much more fiber in it. So there's going to be collagen, right? Collagen fibers in there. And some of these joints can be slightly movable. All right, so for instance, the joint between the vertebral bodies that does allow for a little flexion and a little extension and maybe a little rotation as well, but not a lot, okay, because then that will damage the disc. And also the pubic symphysis is another really good example of a symphysis type of joint, which is fibrocartilage. And this pubic symphysis normally doesn't allow for a lot of motion, except in a couple circumstances I can think of, for instance, during parturition, right, during childbirth, this joint dissolves away so that the pubic bones can separate a little bit, and of course then that enlarges the birth canal, and then after parturition, the pubic bones come back together and that pubic symphysis reforms, mostly, okay. And also, I've known a couple guys to separate their pubic bones, unfortunately, as they go through the handlebars of their motorcycle by accident. Okay, yeah, that sounds pretty nasty, but that's probably better than actually breaking something off. Okay. All right, so those are symphysis types of joints and some pretty good examples. All right, the third kind of a joint by classification. Yeah, you're welcome to come on through. Okay, is a synovial joint. And all synovial joints have something in common beside their structure, and that is that each and every synovial joint, pretty much by definition and because of their structure, is a diarthrosis. All right, and the diarthrosis belongs to that scheme of SAD, and it's the last term, D, which means what? The least movable or most movable? Most movable, right? So all synovial joints are diarthroses or freely movable joints, and we're going to see why that is. Okay, so synovial joints are characterized by a fluid-filled joint cavity. That's one of the things. Ah, here's a pretty good example. Here's the slide on the right. Here is a synovial joint, and so this right here is an exam figure, I'm sure. All right, so let me see how much can I enlarge this one. All right, I've enlarged it probably as much as I can. And so you have to know these different pieces and how to label this diagram. So here we have two long bones, and this might be between a couple phalanges, for instance, in one of your digits. And so here is the distal epiphysis of one bone, here's the proximal epiphysis of the other, and on the condylar surface of these long bones, right, the condylar surface is going to be nice and smooth, it is covered with hyaline cartilage. So here I see a layer of hyaline cartilage, and another layer right here of hyaline cartilage, and if it's in a joint, sometimes we call that articular cartilage. So articular cartilage and hyaline cartilage are exactly the same material. Maybe you could even picture what it looks like underneath a microscope. Doesn't have any fibers, kind of translucent, has lacunae with chondrocytes on the inside of it. All right, it's very light, can't withstand a lot of trauma or pressure or force. And if you remember looking at hyaline cartilage, it also is devoid of blood vessels, doesn't have blood vessels. So it can be damaged pretty easily, and because it doesn't have a blood supply, it means it does not regenerate either with any kind of efficiency. Okay, but it does protect the condylar surfaces of both of these bones, and it's kind of slippery because it's lubricated by a fluid in this area right here that we call synovial fluid. And synovial fluid has sugar proteins in it that kind of make it a slippery substance, and that also helps to nourish some of the chondrocytes that are in the lacunae and the articular cartilages of this synovial joint. And that synovial fluid is secreted by the synovial membrane. That's the deepest part of the joint capsule, and it is continually weeping fluid into this space right here that we call the joint cavity, which is filled with synovial fluid, right? And that helps nourish the chondrocytes in this area right here. So we got articular cartilage, the joint cavity filled with synovial fluid, and the synovial membrane that secretes that fluid into the cavity. And then there is a fibrous capsule, okay, right here that lies right superficial to the synovial membrane. That helps stabilize the joint, that helps protect the synovial membrane. And if we put the synovial membrane together with this fibrous connective tissue, then we call that the articular capsule or joint capsule, right? So the capsule is made out of the fibrous capsule and the synovial membrane put together. All right, so all synovial membranes have this kind of structure, with the addition that some joints might even have some other cartilage, right, space between the two bones, and that kind of cartilage is going to be fibrocartilage, and that's what we would call a meniscus, right, and that further helps protect the ends of the bones. Right, I might want to talk about some of those slides in just a little bit. Ooh, I want some joints that have articular cartilage in them. Okay, for instance, this one here. Okay, so here is the knee joint, and here is a fibrocartilage pad, which is a meniscus separating the condyles of the femur with the condyles of the tibia right here. And there is a meniscus in the temporomandibular joint, and there is a meniscus in the between the first rib and the manubrium. There's also an articular cartilage in there. Okay, so I do want you to know all these things. Articular cartilage, joint cavity, the joint capsule, synovial fluid, synovial membrane. That's good. Ah, there's some other things too. Okay. Let's go back and look at some of these other things. Okay, so we talked about everything on this slide so far, and even your imagination, you should put what a meniscus between these two bones for some joints. And then, even superficial to the articular capsule, we have some dense regular connective tissue that spans the whole joint. So this is a ligament, right? So joints have ligaments to further stabilize joints. And so that's a reinforcing ligament. Some parts of these structures right here have blood vessels and maybe have nerves, so when this joint is damaged or is about to be damaged, you would feel pain. Okay, and now let's talk about a bursa and a tendon sheath. Okay, so picture this synovial joint right here, and what could you tell me about the nature of this joint and when these two bones touch each other? What is special about this joint because of the fluid in there and the membrane and this hyaline cartilage? It's what? Is it sticky or is it slippery? It's kind of slippery so that these bones can slide over each other, right? Maybe maybe they can rotate around each other or slide over each other without damaging either bone. So it's a very slippery kind of system in here. All right, and when things slip back and forth very easily, then inflammation does not resolve. Right, so bones can move nice and freely. But when bones can't slip and slide over each other, that produces inflammation, which means then that blood vessels to this area will dilate. The synovial membrane might start secreting a lot of fluid into the joint capsule right here, or into the joint cavity. All right, and that's going to further restrict motion of this particular joint, so that when you use it, it produces more inflammation. Okay, and then that inflammation reduces mobility of the joint, so when you use it, that produces more inflammation, which then restricts the mobility of this joint, so that when you use it, it produces more inflammation. So it's kind of like a positive feedback mechanism, right, that can make somebody really miserable and reduces the mobility and usefulness of that joint, right? So then you need some way to break that positive feedback with anti-inflammatory drugs. Maybe you can take orally or with shots, for instance, like cortisol shots, right? Or maybe somebody actually has to do surgery on this joint to pull out something that is causing inflammation, like a broken piece of hyaline cartilage. All right, so the basic concept of a synovial joint is that it should be really nice and slippery and prevent inflammation is the purpose of a nice synovial joint. Well, there's something that's very similar to a synovial joint, but it's not really a joint itself. It's something that we call a bursa or a tendon sheath. All right, and a bursa and a tendon sheath have pretty much the same kind of architecture. There's a fibrous capsule, there's a synovial membrane with a cavity on the inside of it that's filled with synovial fluid, which makes it very slippery. And we have a number of these things in different parts of our body. And in particular, let me see, this diagram right here. Ah, this is really good. Okay, so what we're looking at is the scapula right here, and we see the glenoid fossa or glenoid cavity on the lateral margin of the scapula, and here's the acromion process. And fitted into this glenoid cavity is the head of the humerus, right? So can you picture where this is in your body? Okay, so it's basically your shoulder joint. Then here is that acromion process that's making the tip of your shoulder. And it doesn't articulate with the head of the humerus because that articulates with the glenoid cavity, but it's very close to this acromion process, right? And the head of the humerus could bump up against the acromion process, and it's going to move in all kinds of different directions, which we're going to talk about in just a little bit, bone motions and how we classify them. All right, so inflammation could develop between the head of the humerus and this acromion process, but there is something that's a very slippery pillow between them. And this thing is what we call a bursa. So there's a synovial membrane in there, there's a fibrous capsule, and there's a cavity and synovial fluid inside the cavity. All right, so this thing can roll back and forth and absorb a lot of trauma to the shoulder joint. Okay, and so it just reduces inflammation between the head of the humerus and the acromion process. And we have these in a number of places in our body, in the knees and in the hips. And of course, if you overdo some kind of exercise and this bursa receives too much trauma to where maybe you rip it a little bit, okay, then it's going to start to become inflamed and swell up, which does what? But if it starts to swell up and you use your shoulder, it produces more inflammation, which then produces more swelling, which produces more inflammation, right? So then you need to rest that shoulder and do something to reduce inflammation in that area. And does anybody know what that's called when a bursa has been overworked or inappropriately worked and it is inflamed? Yeah, that's bursitis. And that can be really painful for certain people, okay? And so you're going to notice a number of bursa in different parts of the body. Okay, so that's a bursa. Think of it as a nice pillow that it could be separating bones from muscles or bones from other bones. because when a muscle contracts, it becomes very, very hard and will pound up against the muscle. Could pound up against the bone. It could damage that bone. So a lot of locations in your body, you might have bursa to separate muscles from bone, or even other tendons. Like I see a tendon running right through here, a tendon from the biceps muscle. All right, when the biceps contracts, it's going to pound these different bones and other ligaments, and a bursa is there to reduce inflammation when that happens. Okay, so here is the tendon from the long head of the biceps brachii, and it goes all the way over the top of the head of the humerus, and it inserts into a little tubercle that's right above the glenoid cavity right here. You had to know that in lab. That's called the supraglenoid tubercle, okay, right here. And it goes right between the intertubercular groove at the proximal end of the humerus. And so this tendon is rubbing up against the humerus all the time. And there's something around this tendon that reduces and prevents inflammation so that you can use that biceps all the time. And that's what we call a tendon sheath. And you can see it wrapping around the tendon, but it has basically the same structure as a bursa, which has the same structure as a synovial cavity. All right, so there is a fibrous membrane with a synovial membrane, and that membrane secretes synovial fluid into the synovial cavity of a tendon sheath. So a bursa looks more like a pillow. A tendon sheath is something that surrounds a tendon, preventing inflammation when that tendon is being used. Okay, so I don't think this is an exam figure, but it's nice because we have a nice bursa and tendon sheath right there. All right, and that can become inflamed just like this. Bursa can be inflamed if you use that muscle inappropriately, like for too long a period of time. But since we're on this picture right here, there's something else that I want to show you. And that is, if you're going to, everybody has looked at these fossa in lab. If we're going to compare the glenoid fossa or glenoid cavity with the acetabulum, okay, and as a matter of fact, probably you should tell me where the acetabulum is. Do you know where the acetabulum is? Yeah, it's in the hip, the coxae, right? It's a fossa as well that accepts the head of the femur. All right, which one is deeper? Yeah, the acetabulum is a lot deeper, okay? The glenoid fossa you see right here is pretty shallow. That allows for more range of motion of the shoulder joint, but that also means that the shoulder joint can be more easily damaged. But there are some extensions of the glenoid cavity that I see right here and right here, some fibrocartilage, right, that completely surrounds the glenoid cavity in all three dimensions, and that's what we call the labrum, the glenoid labrum, okay? And, of course, since that's made out of cartilage, it's not as strong as bone. That's another place where somebody can damage a shoulder by ripping or displacing the labrum around that joint. So I know if you're interested in sports or whatever, okay, people use that term all the time. And the labrum is this cartilage right here that helps to stabilize the shoulder joint by making the glenoid fossa a little bit deeper. Okay, but it's still a nice light material compared to bone, so that has an advantage too, right? Lightness always has an advantage for mobility. Okay, and then you can see the fibrous capsule over here, the synovial membrane that secretes synovial fluid into the joint cavity. Okay, so that's a pretty good description of the shoulder joint. Okay. Somebody asked me about damage to a joint, and I forget exactly what it was in lab. Okay, we're going to go to the knee and talk about the knee in a little bit. Okay, so know something about bursa and tendon sheaths. And now this is kind of a fun part of lecture. Let's talk about movements that are allowed by various kinds of joints. So you have some pictures of motion. And so I guess I'll just kind of look at some of these things. We'll just look at this one right here and then go. Okay, so with your wrist, we're looking at what bones do you have in your wrist? Yeah, you've got carpals. And a lot of the surfaces, articulating surfaces of the carpals are kind of flat, all right? And so you can do this motion like waving with your wrist, right? If you're in a parade sometime. So there are couples that are gliding over each other because the joints are pretty flat. Okay, so that's a gliding kind of motion, rocking back and forth like that. Okay, let's talk about flexion and extension. Most of the motions between bones come in pairs. Okay, there is one motion and there's an opposite motion to it. And flexion is a motion where you have two bones and the angle between the two bones is decreasing. Let me see if I can turn this up. Oh no, that makes this... Does that wipe out the screen if I put that on? Can you tell? Is that bad or doesn't affect the screen one way or the other? Okay. I'll leave it on for the people in the back row up there so you can see what you're doing. Okay, flexion and extension are opposite motions. And that's probably the most important concept in this class. And maybe we talked about it last time. Since these are opposite motions, we call that antagonism. And so there are muscles that produce this antagonistic motion, but that's a very beneficial thing for your body to have. Just like the gas pedal and brake pedal in your car, you need both of those mechanisms, which are antagonistic to each other, to precisely control a car. All right, so when you, if you think of the humerus and two bones of the forearm, and that forms a 180-degree bend in my elbow, right, it's just a flat elbow, if I bring my forearm up like that, decreasing the angle between these bones, we call that flexion, right? And if I increase the angle, we call that extension, right? Flexion and extension, and that can happen with numerous joints in your body. For instance, your fingers can flex and can extend, okay? Your thumb. Let's see what other joints can do that. Your knee can flex, okay, and extend. Decreasing the angle is flexion, increasing the angle is extension. The same thing for the hip, for instance. Think of the trunk and your thigh right here is forming a straight line, all right, but I can decrease that angle. It's 180 degrees now. I can decrease it by using some muscles, right? So now it's 90, right? That's decreasing the angle. So this is flexion, and this motion, tell me what I just did. Extended the thigh, and what else you could say is either the part of the body that is being moved or the joint that moves, right? So this right here is flexion of the forearm or flexion at the elbow. They're exactly the same kind of terms, right? And so then this would be extension of the forearm or extension of the elbow. What about this motion right here? That's flexion of the thigh or flexion of the hip. Either one of those terms are fine. All right, so if this is flexion, what is this motion? Extension. Now, there's something else that you can do sometimes with extension, okay? And for instance, let's talk about the wrist right here. This is flexion, right? And then this is extension. And what else can you do with the wrist? You can go beyond 180 degrees. You can do that, and that's called hyperextension. So some joints you can hyperextend without damaging the joint. For instance, like the vertebral column, right? You got flexion, extension, hyperextension. Got to be careful with that a little bit, all right? The wrist, you can hyperextend. And what about the hip? The hip, you've got flexion, extension, and hyperextension. So the hip, you can hyperextend as well. But if you look at the joints of your digits, you can flex, you can extend. Can you hyperextend? Well, maybe these joints over here, but not the joints of your fingers. Maybe some people can, okay, but you're really not supposed to hyperextend the finger. Like if you catch a softball wrong or something and you hyperextend it, right, that's going to damage that joint. Okay, so that's flexion and extension. Flexion and extension of the vertebral column. Flexion is when you're bending anteriorly, extension is posteriorly, and then past standing straight up would be hyperextension. Okay, so here is flexion of the leg, right? Because here's the thigh, or you can say flexion at the knee. Okay, and then extension, for instance. All right, now here is a strange kind of motion when we talk about the shoulder. Because when you're in anatomic position, All right? And you think of your feet, for instance, your palms are facing posteriorly, but the soles of your feet are actually kind of pointing posteriorly. All right? Also, your elbow, when you flex your elbow, your forearm moves anteriorly. But when you flex your knee, where does your leg move? Does it move anteriorly like your arm? Because it's been twisted around, it moves posteriorly. All right? So our upper appendage and lower appendage don't match each other perfectly. Okay, so for the shoulder joint right here, we do have flexion and extension. And I can't describe to you why an angle is increasing or decreasing for flexion and extension at the shoulder, but I can show you an easy way to remember. All right, so for flexing the shoulder, you want to move your arm, okay, anteriorly or up. That's flexion. And then extension is to bring it back down by your side. And then if you move it behind yourself like that, we would call that hyperextension. Right? And so this is all flexion of the humerus, right? And then extension. So how are you going to remember that moving your humerus anteriorly like that is flexion? Well, it matches up with your thigh. Okay? Remember, this is what? Flexion. Okay, and if you do the same thing with your arm, flexion for both, extension for both. All right, so can you kind of make a picture, a little motion picture video in your mind of how flexion and extension works for the upper appendage, because it matches up with the thigh pretty nicely. Okay, so clearly this is extension of the arm. Okay. All right, there's some other kinds of motions. For instance, your fingers, you can bring your fingers all together, or you can separate your fingers like that, you know, like the Spock symbol kind of thing, right? And that has a motion. When you move your limbs or digits away from midline, okay, we call that abduction, okay, and you can do that with your toes and your leg as well. That's abduction. And when you bring your appendages back to midline, we call that adduction. So when just think of adding your arms and legs back to your body, that is adduction. And same thing with your fingers. So this motion right here, tell me what this motion is. Abduction, and when you add them together, that is adduction. Okay, and so you can do that with your arms, legs, fingers, toes, that kind of thing. Okay, now ball and socket joints. What can you do with this shoulder joint? All right, so if I do that, that is abduction, and you can adduct. You can also do this. This is flexion. Remember your hip flexion and extension. Okay. There's another motion that you can do with your humerus, okay, which is not flexion, extension, adduction, and abduction. You can actually rotate it in position, okay? You can do this kind of thing, all right? And notice that I'm not turning, I'm not actually supinating and pronating. I'm not doing anything with the radius and ulna. I'm just rotating the humerus back and forth. And maybe another good way of seeing that is if I flex at the elbow, okay, and then move my humerus, rotate it laterally, rotate it medially. That's another kind of motion, a rotation. All right, so the ball and socket joint of the shoulder can do all kinds of interesting things. Can rotate, right? It can abduct and adduct. It can flex and extend. And it can be a combination of all those kinds of motions, which is a windmill motion like this. Okay, and that's a complicated motion. We call that circumduction. Circumduction you can do with ball and socket joints like the hip joint and the shoulder joint, making a windmill motion. Okay, we just talked about lateral rotation. All right, so lateral rotation of the humerus is out to the side. Medial rotation is bringing your hand toward your belly button. And you could also do a rotation of your head. Now, where is that joint that allows you to rotate your head? Okay, between C1 and C2, right? Not between the occipital bone and C1. Right, so that's rotation. Elevation and depression are paired motions. For instance, you could do that with your shoulders. You can elevate your shoulders and you can depress your shoulders. Right? You can elevate your jaw, your mandible. Okay, by chomping down on something, you can depress the mandible by opening up your mouth. And then there is protraction and retraction. All right, protraction is pushing some part of your body forward, like, for instance, your shoulders. You can protract, or you can retract your shoulders by putting them back, and you can do the same thing with your mandible, but be careful you don't chip a tooth, right? You can poke your mandible out like that, or you can draw it back into your head. That would be retraction. All right, another important kind of motion having to do with the radial ulnar joint. And in anatomic position, your palms are facing anteriorly, okay? But you can rotate the radius over the ulna by doing this. So now they're crossing over each other so that your palms are facing posteriorly. All right, so when you go from anatomic position to your palms facing posteriorly, we call that pronation. When you go from palms posterior to anterior again, we call that supination. All right, so I kind of remember that because I hear a lot of P's when I say palms of the hands facing posteriorly. That's pronation. Pronation, palms posterior, okay? And when your palms are anterior like that, if you bring them together and cup your hands a little bit, that forms a soup bowl, okay? So that is supination. So that's an easy one to remember as well. Even though you see a little complication between the relationship of the radius and the ulna, and between these two bones you have, right, that fibrous joint that is movable, the interosseous membrane between the ulna and radius. And I think this is our last, it's not our last motion, almost our last motion. All right, so with your digits you can, we can do what with your digits? Flex and extend, exactly right. And you can do that with your thumb. You can flex and extend. But the thumb joint is an interesting kind of joint. It's a saddle joint. It allows for more than just a hinge motion, more than just flexion and extension. It also allows this kind of motion, okay, where it can actually move anterior to your hand. We call that opposition, so that you can actually pinch things and grasp things. All right, so that oppositional motion, it's due to this joint down over here. All right, then in the ankle we have inversion and eversion. Inversion is, for instance, when you try to stand on your lateral malleolus, your fibula. Okay, and ankles aren't very stable in that kind of motion, and when somebody sprains an ankle, that's typically the motion that they sprain an ankle with, and it stretches the ligaments out in this in the ankle in this region right here. Eversion is when you try to stand on your medial malleolus, like the tibia. And that's more difficult to do because there are many and stronger ligaments that go across the medial side of your ankle compared to the lateral side over here. All right, but if you ever do evert an ankle, it's a much more serious injury because that means that you damage more and stronger ligaments when that happened to you. So the recovery time is going to be a lot longer. Okay, so that's inversion and eversion. Ah, no, you know what? There's even more motions. Okay, this is the last motion. This is a good one to know, but it's not straightforward. Okay, and again, because your upper appendage has different structure compared to your lower appendage, if you do this with the wrist, we call that flexion, and if you do that, that's extension. So you would think, well, maybe we can do the same thing with our ankle, but remember, these bones are kind of twisted around in the lower appendage. So we don't classically have flexion and extension at the ankle. The two motions we have are both flexion kinds of motions, and one is called dorsiflexion, and the other is plantar flexion. So dorsiflexion is when you move your toes more anteriorly, or a better way of thinking of it is when you lift your toes up off the ground. That's dorsiflexion. And when you point your toes into the ground or posteriorly, we call that plantar flexion, when you're pointing your toes into the ground. All right, so that's an important motion that rotates right around this location right here. And that's really important because some people have trouble dorsiflexing, lifting their toes up off the ground when they work. And I know physicians, even veterinarians, will look at the toenails of your dog when you take it in, okay? And physicians will look at the tips of their patient's shoes, right? Because if you're not dorsiflexing, if you can't dorsiflex, then you're going to be dragging the tips of your shoes over the ground, and they're going to get worn out. And that's a really nice sign of spinal cord injury, right? So it's a pretty easy diagnosis to make, and that's really important diagnosis to make, especially with somebody that's in their 80s, 70s, or 80s, because as they're walking and their toes are kind of dragging over the ground, what can happen to them? They can trip on something, a little crack in a sidewalk or something. And when you're that age, probably you have osteoporosis, so that means a big major bone in your body is going to break, like a hip or a femur or something like that. And then you're really hard to take care of. You can't stay at home if you're living by yourself. You have to move into a nursing home or some kind of recovery facility. And you're not around your family. You're around very foreign kind of atmosphere. And a lot of times people at that age just kind of give up the will to live when that happens to them, right? So that's kind of an important thing that people look at all the time, right? It's amazing. Just by looking at shoes, you can maybe, you know, help save somebody's life. And then you can maybe get treatment for that problem, all right, that spinal cord injury or nerve root injury, to where they can walk normally again. All right, so if you have a grandma or grandpa that can't dorsiflex, you got to really help them. If you're out with them walking, help stabilize them, right, because you don't want them to fall. Okay. So the last thing we're going to talk about, oh, besides the knee, let's see, I don't know if we can get to the knee today or not. Yeah, maybe so. Our shapes of the articulating surfaces. So there are a number of things that can stabilize a joint. Okay, one thing is the shape of the joints, just the structure of the joint itself. And I think we compared the shoulder joint with the hip joint. Both are ball and socket, but one is a bigger ball and socket, a deeper ball and socket joint. And that is the hip, right? So that means it's a more stable joint, it's a stronger joint, but you sacrifice mobility. You don't have the same dexterity with the hip joint. Okay, there's some other joints, like gliding joints that we have in the hand right here. Okay, these are fairly stable joints, but they don't allow a lot of mobility. Okay, so sometimes we call these plane joints because it's just a little flat surface right here. And the way that this joint moves is in two directions, either right or left or anterior posteriorly. These joints can slide over each other just a little bit. All right, so we call that a transitional kind of joint, non-axial motion. There's no rotation. There's no hint of rotation one way or the other with this particular joint. All right, so a carpal-metacarpal joint would be a really good example of that. Okay, uniaxial movement. Some examples. For instance, this is a hinge joint right here, like between the ulna, right, and in particular, what, the trochlear notch within and surrounding the trochlea of the humerus right here. That joint is strictly a hinge joint. It just allows flexion and extension, right? You can't pronate and supinate at that particular joint. That the supination and pronation is due to the notches in the ulna and the radius in this location right here. But this is just uniaxial motion, flexion and extension, and that's it. We call that a hinge joint. So what examples do we have? The ankle for dorsiflexion and plantar flexion, and flexion and extension of the elbow, and the interphalangeal joints between the phalanges of your digits. That's just purely a hinge joint, right? You can't rotate those phalanges. You can't abduct and adduct those phalanges. You can only, what, flex and extend. It's only around one axis of motion. Okay. Okay, another kind of joint is a pivot joint, like the radial ulnar joint between the head of the radius and the radial notch of the ulna right here for pronation and supination. All right, between C1 and C2, that's a rotation. And again, that's just a uniaxial kind of motion. Condyloid joints. Okay. Like between the phalanx and this metacarpal right here. All right, we see this nice condylar surface. And so that kind of joint, we call that biaxial, because you can flex and extend. You can also do what? You can abduct and adduct that joint. So it's more range of motion for both flexion and extension and abduction and adduction. That's a condyloid type joint. And The next really cool joint, okay, is even a little bit more complicated than a condyloid. We call this a saddle type of joint. All right, and this is the joint that you have down here in your thumb. All right, so with your thumb, what can you do? You can flex and extend, but you can also undergo opposition with it. All right, so this is another biaxial kind of motion. There are two axes at which you can move your thumb at. All right, because it's a saddle-shaped joint. So you can move laterally as well as anteriorly and posteriorly as a result. And then our last joint is that ball and socket joint. And that's a multi-axial kind of joint. So you can abduct, adduct, you can flex and extend, and you can rotate. Right? And if you put all three of these motions together at the same time, we call that circumduction. Right? That's circumduction. Okay. So those are some classifications by the structure of a joint. All right, so the structure of a joint determines what kind of motion it has or is allowed. That's one way a joint is stabilized. All right, it is also stabilized by ligaments that go across the joint. All right, so let's see, we want to spend some time. Oh, what was this right here? Ah, that articular disc. All right, so you got the knee, you got the temporal mandibular joint. Here is the clavicular-manubrial joint right here that has a little articular cartilage forming that disc. Right, not too many places in your body has it. Okay, and there that articular disc is in the TMJ joint, just like your knee. All right, but what I really want to show you is a knee. Oh, you can see the labrum right here of the shoulder. Okay, elbow we're not so interested in. Okay, and here is the knee. Oh, we're talking about stability of a joint. I forgot what I was talking about. Okay, stability of a joint. Okay, you have, of course, the articular capsule, which is a fibrous capsule. That's dense, irregular connective tissue. It's not a very strong kind of connective tissue, but it does stabilize a joint to some degree, all right? And another thing would be ligaments that span the joint. Where are some ligaments? Ah, like the lateral collateral ligament and medial collateral ligament that goes across the knee. That helps stabilize the knee. And another ligament, the patellar ligament right here, helps stabilize the knee. All right, but these can be stretched, all right? They can be damaged, and that might damage the joint surfaces as well. But there's something else even more important that stabilizes a joint, and that is the muscles that attach to tendons that actually act across a particular joint. So that, for instance, when a knee is damaged or any other kind of joint, the best way that you can recover the proper motion and health of the joint is that you can't really exercise these ligaments because they don't have their own blood supply. They stay stretched out. But what can you exercise? The muscles that work across the joint. So probably the most important thing that stabilizes a joint are the muscles that act at that particular joint. So if somebody's in knee rehab, guess what they're working on? Not necessarily the knee, but they're working on the muscles in the thigh, okay, and maybe some muscles in the leg that work across the knee, and that will help them recover the function of their knee. All right, so some of these tendons and ligaments you have to know for the test. So remember, a tendon is a muscle-to-bone connection, like we see right here between the muscles that we call the quadriceps, that's in your anterior thigh, and the patella, so that's the tendon of the quadriceps muscle. And a ligament is a bone-to-bone connection, like the connection between the patella and the tibia. And you should probably know what this little connection point is right here. That's a process. That's called the tibial tuberosity. Is that labeled on here? No, it's not labeled. But you got to know that by now, right? Because that's important for maybe even the practicum coming up, okay? Okay, tibial tuberosity, that's an important process. Okay, and the tibia compared to the fibula, what is the tibia? Is it medial or lateral in your leg?
Medial.
It's medial, so the fibula is lateral. So here is a collateral ligament that goes over the whole joint capsule. And So it goes from the femur down to the head of the tibia right here. Sometimes we call that the medial collateral ligament because it's medial. And sometimes we call it the tibial collateral ligament. So it runs around with a couple different names. And you just have to be familiar with both of those names. A ligament on the lateral side performs the same kind of function. We call that the fibular collateral ligament, or you could call it the lateral collateral ligament. Same thing, because what the fibula is lateral. All right, so those are some important ligaments. One, two, three, and then, one, two, three ligaments, and then here's a tendon that stabilizes the knee joint. Now, we do want to look at the interior of the knee to see some more structures. So what have we looked at so far? The tendon from the quadriceps, the ligament from the patella to the tibial tuberosity, the collateral ligaments that we see here and here. But we see a couple other ligaments that are deep inside the knee that go from the intercondylar notch down to the intercondylar eminence between the condylar surfaces of the tibia. And these two ligaments cross over each other, and hence we call those cruciate ligaments. There's an anterior one and a posterior one. So the anterior one we call the anterior cruciate ligament. The one in the back is the posterior cruciate ligament. And this is the other joint that has an articular disc. It has two of them that we call menisci. They're made out of fibrocartilage. So this would be the lateral meniscus, right, because it matches up with the fibula. And this is the medial meniscus right here that matches up with the tibia. And that also helps stabilize the knee joint. But the most important thing stabilizing the knee joint is muscle, right, like the quadriceps muscle anteriorly and the hamstring muscles, which are in the posterior thigh, right, will stabilize the knee joint more than anything else, or at least those can be rehabbed. Now, the meniscus right here, fibrocartilage, is the toughest kind of cartilage, but in some places of the meniscus, it is very thin. And notice that it kind of looks like a letter C. Each meniscus kind of looks like a letter C, and as you get to either end of the C, it is tapered, it becomes very thin. And so that's the weakest part of the meniscus. So if somebody's going to tear meniscus, typically it happens right at the end, maybe right over here or right over here. Okay, or maybe this medial part is also thin compared to the lateral part, or maybe a tear will occur in this part of a meniscus because that's the thinner part. And it could break away from the rest of the meniscus, and then you have this wedge-shaped structure floating around inside the knee, and depending on when and how you use the knee, that wedge can actually wedge into different parts of your knee and cause the knee to lock up, right? So if somebody says, oh, my knee locked up, they're serious that it can actually happen, right, because of this meniscus when it breaks up and can wedge itself into some place of your knee, right? And when that happens, that part of the meniscus has to be removed. And we don't really know how to repair a meniscus, but years ago, people were treated by just a total radical removal of a meniscus, a total meniscus, right, when they had a torn meniscus. And then what would happen to the knee? You're missing part of it, it would become very unstable, but now you have, right, a lot of weight bearing down on this knee, this hyaline cartilage, the articular cartilage on the condylar surface of the femur and the condylar surface of the tibia would rub up against each other, and then that eventually would produce arthritis, right, a severe form of arthritis. So nowadays, when somebody has a torn meniscus, right, the surgeon preserves as much as possible to protect the function of that knee. All right, so you need a specialist to do that kind of treatment. All right, so try to picture this leg right here. All right, and the thigh. So here we have a knee, and the knee is purely a hinge joint for flexion and extension. All right, just like maybe your finger can flex and extend. But you have a lot of weight on top of it, and there are times when maybe it does rotate. And when it rotates, it's going to damage the meniscus and maybe damage some of these ligaments. All right, and remember, the knee can only flex and extend, but what happens if you have a severe blow to the anterior part of the leg? It's going to, and the femur is held stationary, right, so the leg is going to move posteriorly, and that will damage the anterior cruciate ligament when that happens. So if you're hit from in front, that damages the anterior cruciate ligament. If you're hit from behind, that's going to move your leg anterior to your femur, and right? That's going to damage this posterior cruciate ligament. Or, for instance, if you get a blow, a lateral blow from the side, that's going to try to, what will be the motion? If you have a lateral force right here on the leg and the thigh is stationary, what kind of motion is going to happen here in the joint, in the knee joint? It's going to try to adduct the knee joint, right? If it's going to move toward midline, right, then this lateral collateral ligament will be damaged. Or if you have trauma from the medial side of your leg into your tibia right here, that could break this medial collateral ligament as well, right? So, and then when those are repaired, the way to get joint function back is to work on strength exercises of the quadriceps. Okay, so here is a good exam figure that shows all the menisci, like the, how do you know this is the lateral meniscus right here? Because it matches up with the fibula. You don't see the head of the femur, and then here is the medial meniscus over here because it matches up with the tibia. So you got to know medial and lateral, the bones that are medial and lateral in the leg, just like you do in the forearm. Okay, so the shoulder is not going to be on the test. Those of you that maybe have problems with your shoulder, okay, you can go and look at that diagram. And we'll talk about the shoulder a little bit more when we get into the muscle chapter. Because there's a common injury called a rotator cuff injury, and that has something to do with the shoulder joint, but also muscles that work across the shoulder joint. Oh, I forgot the microphone today. Too late. All right, I'll try to somebody remind me next time. All right, so sign-in sheet. I would like to have that sign-in sheet back, please.